It's Wednesday, September 14th, 2016, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Ernest Perry and Ryan Thomas. On our program this week, Facebook pulls down and then puts back up that iconic Vietnam War photo of the naked girl running following a napalm attack. We're also going to talk about the role of the local gossip columnist and what happens when they go from reporting on the comings and goings of local bigwigs to becoming the local cyber bully and getting paid for it. And we'll talk about Matt Lauer's performance on last week's candidate forum on NBC and the pressure that that's putting on the other debate moderators. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour's up, but let's start with the many headlines that came from the campaign trail this week and how the news media has approached them. Sure, 10 days ago, we were all laughing at Hillary Clinton's allergy to Donald Trump. It was an attempt at making a joke at a pretty awful-sounding cough. That awful cough turned into full-blown pneumonia. That was made public on Sunday after the candidate left the 9/11 memorial early, having overheated and stumbled pretty obviously on her way into a van. It took about 90 minutes for there to be any true clarity into what the situation was and why she left Ground Zero for her daughter Chelsea's apartment. First, a statement from the campaign saying she was overheated and needed to cool down, then one from her doctor explaining the pneumonia diagnosis and the need for some ongoing rest. This turned into what was already a pretty rough weekend, and trust me, we're going to get to that basket of deplorables comment. It made it much worse because of the renewed claims that Hillary Clinton is just not transparent about anything, including her health.
Well, I mean, this goes back to something that the campaign has been struggling with almost from the beginning of when she announced that she was running for president, which is she is wants to be in control of the message and goes to great lengths to make sure that that happens. And she likes to keep a distance from the media. And so when she was seen stumbling, trying to get into the van, everyone was starting to ask questions as it related to Trump's claim that she's not fit to be president for health reasons. And so it just all sort of played into what you call a perfect narrative storm for Trump. And then the doctor comes out and says, okay, well, she has pneumonia. She needs to take a couple of days off the campaign trail. Then Clinton coming back, basically saying, well, I should listen to my doctor, but as most people do, I just tried to power through and move on and do what I needed to do. And so it just this leads into what we have now, which is this, these questions about her health.
So pneumonia is usually one of those things that it's going to knock you on your butt for a while, but after a course of antibiotics or two, you're pretty much good to go. So to hear some of the discussion maybe on cable news or in some different publications questioning her mental capacity and whether or not that this could affect her ability mentally to serve as president, is that fair?
I think the information about a candidate's health is in the or president's health is in the public interest, but it must be based on evidence, i.e. actual reporting, and it must be proportional, right? Both proportional in terms of the significance of the illness and proportional in terms of the overall spectrum of coverage. What I'm not seeing a lot of is I'm not seeing a lot of actual reporting or journalism, but a whole lot of punditry, a whole lot of speculation. What does this mean? Is she mentally impaired? I mean, I was amazed to find out on Twitter that there were so many journalists who are actually practicing physicians who are just experts in pneumonia, right? Just this rampant speculation, which ultimately does not serve the public interest.
But, I mean, it sort of goes along the line of what we've seen throughout the campaign, where you have journalists who are giving their opinions, and then the facts come later.
Yeah.
And those facts are usually to support whatever opinion they gave the first time. So it's sort of this sort of self-perpetuating cycle of punditry, then facts, and then back and forth and back and forth. And you never really know what's going on. But that's what we live in now in the age of Trump, where facts don't really matter. It's what the candidate says and continues to say. And then journalists, are, instead of going to say, okay, wait a minute, is this true or not true? They dump their own opinion on top of that. So you never really get to what is true and what's not true.
So let's actually kind of circle that back, because I do want to get to the basket of deplorables comment. On Friday, Hillary Clinton claimed that roughly half of Trump's supporters could be characterized as either racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, or Islamophobic. And that gave birth to all of the internet memes you could imagine. Giant picnic baskets, comic book heroes with Trump and his supporters' heads photoshopped onto them. Clinton hedged the comment, saying she was being grossly generalistic, and even said it was wrong to say half, but reiterating that it is deplorable that Donald Trump has built a campaign largely on prejudice and paranoia. A lot of the news coverage of this statement centered on how wrong it was of her to make the statement, but it does kind of ring true, even if it wasn't so delicately said. And Ernest, you actually came into my office yesterday morning and wanted to point out very specifically an article about that to me.
Yeah, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who writes for The Atlantic and is one of this generation's best sort of political and cultural writers, was pointing out in the article that he wrote in The Atlantic, which is on our Links blog, that if you actually go through and you look at her entire quote, you'll see that she did try to quantify what she was talking about. And if you then go out and do a little bit of reporting, what you'll find out is that there's some truth to her statement if you look at the people who are supporting Trump or the fringe that is supporting Trump and their beliefs and what they've said. It sort of plays out into what Hillary Clinton was saying when she made that statement.
Yeah, I think if we sort of take away the sort of the deplorables part, I mean, and look at what the survey data tells us, is that these are people who hold views, for example, that the president is Muslim or wasn't born in the U.S. These are people who survey data tells us believe that black people are more inclined towards criminality, people who believe that Hispanic people are inherently lazy. So, I mean, what we see here is sort of like the triumph of sort of horse race journalism in terms of saying, is this a gaffe, is this a campaign gaffe, versus journalism that would put that into context to say, well, actually, some of these things are factually accurate in terms of describing the characteristics and views of this marginal group of people.
I mean, the problem I have, and this goes back to the statement I made earlier, is that journalists aren't looking for the facts. They feel as if they have to respond immediately to whatever the candidate is saying and then start doing the reporting. And that's what's leading to a lot of this coverage. And I think that, you know, to me, it just seems like people are really getting sort of burnt out on what's going on with this election. I've read several articles over the last couple of days where you have some reporters who are actually looking at fatigue on the part of the electorate in terms of this race. And I think that what they're afraid of, and this is in looking at political scientists, what they're afraid of is that this fatigue could lead to low voter turnout. And so the polls may not mean anything when we get to that point because people are just tired.
Do you think the fatigue is a result of these two candidates and what the narrative of this whole election cycle has been? Or could some of that fatigue also be the result of the fact that a presidential election cycle now almost seems to be two full years? Like, we have been covering this presidential election for what feels like ever.
Well, I think it's all of those. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's actually been brought up is there a way to shorten the election cycle in the United States the way it's done in other places? I mean, you have, you know, in Great Britain and in Canada, their election cycles last maybe about 6 months. Mm-hmm. Ours is 2 years. But in order to be able to do that, some people are saying you've got to take the money out of it. And you've got to take a lot of the things that we've come to sort of embrace in the American political system out of it in order to shorten it. And so that's going to be a problem. But I think it does contribute to the fatigue that many in the public are experiencing right now.
Yeah, you see, I mean, one of the reasons why we see a lot of sort of what we call horse race coverage is because the structure, the system is set up for that. We have this long campaign. People are seeking money for going fundraising long before the actual election begins. And so it's sort of inevitable that you sort of see a journalism that then slots into that groove. And so perhaps we need to talk about sort of structural solutions here rather than just pinning it on journalism.
But I also, you know, I think also one of the things that's unique to this particular campaign is a suspension of fact-based reporting at the beginning. And a lot of it is driven by the hyper-partisanship of this, which Trump sort of uses to his benefit. I mean, you know, a lot of what Hillary Clinton experienced over the last week has been built up by Trump and his supporters talking about her health, talking about her fitness to be president. I mean, they've been talking about this since January. And then when she stumbles at the 9/11 memorial, all of a sudden they jump on it and say, this affirms all the things that we've been talking about. And so then all of a sudden the facts become what they've been saying for the last 6 to 7 months.
Well, so let me ask you a question about Donald Trump. He gave an interview to his old friend Larry King and was under the impression, he says, that that interview was meant for a podcast. Was there ever any question in your minds that this was ever going to, as it did, end up running on Vladimir Putin's Russia Today?
Well, Larry King is sort of interesting because he sort of provides Russia Today with a sort of veneer of respectability. I mean, Russia Today is helpful for providing the Kremlin perspective on the news, right? And what's worrying to me is the extent to which both with Trump and Russia Today and also things like WikiLeaks, the extent to which Russia is influencing or attempting to influence the electoral process here. As for who knew what was going on, I would tend to side with King. I think that King would knows what his show
what his
is going on.
Was, yeah.
I think that, but and given that we have a candidate who clearly will just lie left, right, and center, I'm more inclined to trust Larry King than Donald Trump here.
I would agree with that. You know, it's very amazed. I mean, I'm amazed at the level at which Putin has been allowed to sort of duck in and out of this presidential campaign, and in some ways has been invited in.
Yeah, and he's literally been given a seat at the table.
I mean,
he has a candidate who praises him and says, "Well, if he praises me, I'm going to praise him."
Right, right. But you know, I look at this and I go like, "But this is the party of Ronald Reagan, who despised Russia." And he would probably look at this and go like, well, wait a minute, this is because you're not talking about the Russia of Gorbachev. You're talking about the Russia of Putin, which is linked back to the KGB and that sort of thing. So I just find the whole thing amazing.
I mean, talk about a sort of a government that does not respect civil liberties, does not respect press freedoms and so on. But yeah, what's alarming is if you look at the polling on Putin's favorability amongst U.S.-based Republicans, he's increasingly favorable. And you sort of wonder the extent to which we've sort of fed the beast, you know, and allowed Putin to play such an outsized role in our own electoral process.
You think that's the result of Donald Trump saying, well, if he likes me, I'm going to like him, and people are following their party's leader at the moment?
I think it's the partisanship. I think people are like, I have to vote this way because this is what I do. This is who I am, and this is the direction in which I'm going to go, because that's the only thing I can see that's driving this, unless there's something else that I don't see.
As a Cold War kid, I kind of look at it just kind of wondering. It's just in amazement and in awe of how it's coming together. Well, we're now about 2 weeks out from the first presidential debate, and thanks to his colleague Matt Lauer, Lester Holt will find the pressure to be fair and keep control of that first debate even stronger. Maybe you caught some of the Commander-in-Chief Forum on NBC News late last Wednesday night, and boy, oh boy, did the critics come down hard on Lauer, saying he asked questions as if he was simply plowing through a checklist, not listening to the answers to ask meaningful follow-ups. The New York Times described one of his questions to Trump as the kind of wiffle ball job interview question you ask the boss's nephew that you know you have to hire anyway. So I'm going to put it to the two of you. Why send in Matt Lauer to do Chuck Todd's job?
I was amazed that Matt Lauer was selected. I mean, I know he's a high-profile NBC figure, but I think what we learned here that he was not up to the job, and so I would question the selection of Lauer or versus somebody like Lester Holt or Chuck Todd or one of their political correspondents. I mean, I get so frustrated with this topic because the journalist is there to scrutinize the candidate on behalf of the audience. They are a journalist in that setting. If they're not going to seek clarifications, follow-ups, etc., there's no point in the moderator being a journalist. You may as well have just a computer there that can keep time and then have, you know, do very little else. They're there to serve as a journalist on behalf of the audience. And if they're not going to do that role, that's a problem.
No, I totally agree. But I mean, I don't understand why they put Matt Lauer on there, because if you go back just a couple of weeks before when he was doing the Lochte interview, mm-hmm. the Ryan Lochte interview, you're going like, well, he let that guy get away. Imagine what is going to happen when you have Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, who, you know, just makes up things on the fly. What's going to happen? And when you look at that, he spent all that time on her emails mm-hmm. and very little time on true substantive commander-in-chief military questions. And then when he gets to Trump, he starts asking these softball questions that really don't get to the heart of the matter about, okay, how do you deal with Putin when he does something that is going to really cause problems for American interests in, say, the Middle East or in Africa or somewhere else in the world? I mean, those are the kinds of questions that I think a political or someone who covers government correspondent would have asked him had they been in that chair as opposed to Matt Lauer.
So last week we had a pretty spirited discussion about whether Chris Wallace has an obligation to correct candidates when they outright lie during a debate. And Ernest, you said he does. I agree with you. Mike, who isn't here this week, didn't. Given that the most Googled question following this forum was, is Matt Lauer a Trump supporter? It kind of begs the question, what do these moderators have facing them in these upcoming debates? What are they going to have to do to keep control and to appear to be not necessarily in the camp of one of the other candidates?
Well, I think, you know, so we have a candidate that's an expert at steamrolling through journalists left, right, and center. And the challenge for journalists becomes up your game, right? You have to be more prepared, more thorough, and more prepared to take criticism as well, and prepared to defend your journalism when you do inevitably encounter criticism. I think this idea that we should sort of just lower the standards rather than say, well, actually, this is an opportunity to achieve excellence in journalism, to up our standards, to up our game, I think is a very sort of self-defeating sort of line of argument.
I think you're right, Ryan. I think one of the challenges that the moderators face, because they are representing journalists and they are representing journalism, is that for a very long time, the mainstream media has been getting beat up by either the left and both the left and the right. Mm-hmm. And now they're going to have to stand up and say, you know what? I'm here to answer questions that the general public wants to know mm-hmm. from both candidates. And if you're going to provide answers that don't fit with the facts, then it is my responsibility to ask you to provide those facts to back up the statements that you're making, and do that in a way that the public knows what your position is going to be.
Yeah, and nobody's pretending that this is easy, but we're talking about very high-profile, sort of superstar A-list journalists who are paid a lot of money to do this, right? I mean, they're not there to just sort of smile and look pretty. They are there to serve as journalists, and that's what we would expect.
And I think you're right. They should be ready to face whatever criticism they're going to get from the left and the right after it's over with, because you're going to get it anyway. Yeah. It's going to happen. So you might as well do what you're there to do, which is to serve the public.
Well, this next topic I want to bring up is sort of political in that it's tangentially about Hillary Clinton, but it's more about how we correct ourselves as journalists when we make a mistake. Regular listeners of our show know that we talked about 2 weeks ago an AP investigation that looked at the number of people who had met with Hillary Clinton during her time as Secretary of State, how many of those folks had made donations to the Clinton Foundation. And the AP shared it on Twitter with a tweet that claimed more than half who met with her did give the foundation money. The AP caught a lot of heat for that tweet because it failed to put that number into context, and as a result, the message was at best misleading, at worst a complete lie. At the time, the AP's executive editor excused the tweet, saying Twitter isn't what AP does best and that it stands by the story. What it doesn't do now is stand by that tweet, and it's deleted it. I have a bit of a problem with this. When we're wrong, we need to be transparent as journalists that we're wrong and correct ourselves, not delete the evidence of our bad journalism. One of the things we talked about when we talked about this a couple weeks ago was that one of the things we need to do is look at platforms like Twitter or like Facebook and treat them with the same level of respect as we do our primary channels. So this presents a problem to simply delete any evidence that they had reported this there.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's an issue for them because they actually came out and talked about it. Mm-hmm. And now to all of a sudden take it off as if it never happened, as a historian, that bothers me because now all of a sudden you've sort of tried to erase a piece of history.
It's downright Orwellian.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And so, you know, they need to be called on the carpet for that and say, hey, wait a minute, you need to put that back up because you responded to it. And I think where you're going here is, you know, what's happened at Gawker now, the Univision has bought them. They've taken down five pieces that Gawker, which Univision now owns, are involved in litigation with the previous owners of it. So now they're trying to say, wait a minute, we want a clean slate. Well, it doesn't work that way if you're still going to be using Gawker as a site, regardless of whether it's the main site or something tangential. That's still there. So you need to deal with that.
And the reason that the Univision bosses claim that they're able to do that is that in buying Gawker Media, they bought the properties, but not necessarily the liabilities.
You bought it all.
Right. Yeah. I was going to say, I don't know that I'd necessarily buy that.
Yeah. Well, I thought with Gawker, I mean, is part of this is it's sort of reaping the whirlwind of its own irresponsibility prior, this sort of the law of unintended consequences. But Gawker's statement, I saw they say that this action, they say, quote, does not reflect an editorial judgment about their content, end quote. But of course it does, because it preempts the verdict of these suits. Of course it is an editorial judgment. So it's a baffling, from a journalist, it makes perfect sense from a business perspective, right? But journalistically, it's really problematic.
Which, and this is that fine line we talk about. You know, we usually talk about that fine line when it comes to advertising mm-hmm. and news. But this is a fine line between making a business decision or a legal decision that you're worried about some sort of litigation. And
where is the scale between business ethics and journalism ethics?
Exactly. And they decided to go, well, we're going to go with business ethics. But maybe that in and of itself isn't ethical either, because now here you are having to defend that decision. So I don't get it.
And thinking about the possibility of erasing history. Yeah. On
the point about the tweets, though, I had an interesting discussion with my media ethics students about this just the other day. And they came at it from a different perspective. They said that because of the speed of social media, the priority is to take the misleading information down rather than sort of put corrections out after the fact and leave the false information or the inaccurate information out there first. And it sort of reminded me of sort of like the old saying that a lie can get halfway around the world before truth can put its mm-hmm. boots on,
yeah,
right? And so that's the way that they perceived it, which wasn't the way that I would have thought about it, but I thought it was a very interesting point to make.
Yeah. Okay, we'll give them their point. I don't know that I have to agree with it. Think about the images that you equate with the Vietnam War. Chances are one of the first that's going to come to mind is that photo of the naked girl running following a napalm attack. It's ingrained in our collective memory. And this week, Facebook removed that photo, claiming it violated the site's terms of service due to the nudity. A Norwegian newspaper reported the move in its publication and accused Mark Zuckerberg of abusing his power in removing it. Facebook defended itself, saying it couldn't allow photos of a nude child in one instance over another, simply because the photo is considered iconic. Eventually, Facebook relented and has put the photo back up. But how much of that do you think is about the backlash as opposed to actually believing in what they were doing?
Oh, it's the backlash.
It's backlash.
It's the backlash. I mean, you know, it's an iconic photo.
Yeah.
It was, matter of fact, that when they put it up, they put it up to say this is one of the five iconic photos which demonstrates the harshness of war. And so you're talking about it in a perspective that sort of sheds light on something that we continue to talk about and deal with mm-hmm. on a daily basis in the Middle East, in parts of Africa, and over the world.
Well, that's kind of one of the questions I have about this, too, is what makes this photo, aside from nudity, any more or less graphic than what we've seen in the past year with Aleppo Boy over the summer, mm-hmm. or the young child who was dead on the beach?
Or the man who was killed and shot by a police officer in the car in Minneapolis and was put up on YouTube. which I'm sure
on Facebook Live, and Mark, Live. Exactly. And Mark Zuckerberg rang praises for yes. that.
Yeah, when I saw this story, the way that I read this is a story of why tech companies need journalists mm-hmm. Who can exercise the kind of discernment, the kind of ability to place things into context, the kind of editorial judgment that all good journalists we'd hope they have. I mean, a technician working at Facebook or an algorithm just sees a photo of a naked child, but a journalist would see the sort of evocative, you know, the sense of history, the sort of that this conjures up at a really important time in American and Asian history, and would have been able to sort of discern that as opposed to an algorithm which would just gone, no, sorry, this is a naked child.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it goes back to the fact that you're going to continue to have these problems as long as you don't have people who understand all the things that Ryan's talking about, looking at what you're putting up there. Facebook is a distribution outlet. It is not a journalism organization. And as long as we keep talking about it, and that's the problem I have with what the Norwegians were saying, is that, you know, he has this sort of control. Well, wait a minute, you know, but he's not really practicing what we call journalism. So I think we need to really be specific about our definitions of that and understand that Facebook, Google, and others are in the distribution business, not in the journalism,
news gathering.
Exactly.
Well, before we go, a story that comes to us out of Minneapolis, where last week KARE-TV reporter Jana Shortle became the story in a way she never wanted to. She was reporting on the death of Jacob Wetterling, a young boy who'd been missing for years. His body was found and his killer confessed. It's a story that gripped the Twin Cities for years and devastated the community when it came to its end last week. Shortle reported it, anchoring her show as she does every day in dark jeans, a top, and a blazer. And the Minneapolis Star Tribune's columnist, known only in print as CJ, wrote a column calling her clothing choice a fashion flub. The story wasn't about Shortle. It never should have been. But a local gossip columnist took a pot shot at her for her clothes, detracting from the real story. Now, I know both of you well enough to know we don't even need to get into what Jana Shortle, who is a grad of our program and one of my former classmates, doesn't matter what she was wearing. What I really want to talk to you about is the role of the gossip columnist. And is there one beyond authorized cyber bully for your publication?
Well, I think, you know, this is a perfect case of the fine line between gossip and, as you say, cyberbullying. Mm-hmm. Being a gossip columnist where you're taking information from someone else that may be conjecture, maybe third hand, fourth hand, and passing it along, that's gossip. She made an opinion. She wrote an opinion about what she thought about this reporter's attire mm-hmm. during the story which she was reporting on. That's not gossip. That's your opinion. And I think that's what really got her into trouble and people responding the way they did about what she did.
I mean, what's sad about this is if you look at the interview and the report that Shortle did, it was compassionate, it was illuminating, it was interesting, it was well done. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about what the gossip columnist said. And so, you know, it's frustrating because I would imagine that Shortle has added more to the sum of human knowledge than what the gossip columnist has, right? I mean, if we're going to talk about the journalism, let's talk about the kind of journalism the gossip columnist does, which is probably not of public interest and not of value.
Okay. Well, we are pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. Read more about what we've talked about today on our links blog under the programs tab at kbia.org. Also, you can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments, questions, see what we'll be talking about next week and more. I'd like to say thank you to Pat Akers for handling the audio for us today. Megan Sheets is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.